He has been rude to them lately. To everyone. Angry all the time without really knowing why. He should try harder. He loves them. He knows that. It is easier to feel it here, after this walk, drinking soda in the sun, than it is when they are home.
Do you remember how we got here?
Hadia asks.
Of course, he says.
And he hopes how he feels with his sisters today will last long after they've returned home. When they reach their street, it is packed with cars from the community. Amar looks over to Malik uncle, who said when he picked them up that their parents had to tell them something. The look on his face suggests he did not expect the cars either. Amar turns to look at his sisters in the back seat. What Hadia sees in his face makes her immediately straighten her posture and lean forward. Look out over the dash at the cars parked on their street, and before Malik uncle has even found a spot, she has taken off her seatbelt and jumped out of the moving vehicle. Amar follows her lead. He hears another door slam, and he knows Huda is running with them too. He knows it is not Mama. He knows it is not Baba. Malik uncle said that Mama and Baba had news for them. But still, let them both be all right, he prays. Their home is filled with people he recognizes who try to hug him. But he drops his backpack by the door and maneuvers through them. His mother is in the living room, her face hidden by her hands. People surrounding her read from religious texts. Please don't let it be Baba. Please let it be anything but him. An auntie who is next to Mama sees them and touches Mama's shoulder. Mama looks up. She has been crying. She holds her arms out for him, and he goes. And she begins to cry when he hugs her, her shoulders shaking, her face pressed against his neck. It's Nana, she says, and she shakes her head. I was waiting for you three to come. I've been waiting for you all afternoon. When he looks at Hadia's face, he sees not only grief, but also guilt. That they had stolen an afternoon for themselves, spent hours exploring under the sun, going against Mama's and Baba's wishes, while at home, Mama waited for them to comfort her. Layla watches her son shiver through the sliding glass door. His hands in his pockets, his shoulders raised. How he likes to complicate what is simple. Warmth easily acquired, an argument easily avoided. She smiles. He is focused on something in the dirt of her garden and presses the toe of his shoe into it. As though he is a child of 7 again and not a young man of 20. The two of them are home alone. Rafiq has taken Huda to visit the graduate school she was accepted in, a university 2 hours away. Huda will be a teacher. It is a good profession for her. Layla has observed her in Sunday school classrooms, how Huda knows when to be stern or gentle, how she is attuned to what each student and situation demands. Layla is not worried for her. Not as worried as she was when Hadia first left. And watching Amar pull his notebook from his back pocket, she realizes, not nearly as worried as she will be when he too goes. One by one they will all go, and she will be left with Rafiq in this house that is again too big for them, as it first was, when she walked in with Huda just a toddler in her arms, and wondered how they would possibly manage to fill the rooms. Amar is in his second year of community college and has been doing well. He is motivated. He is responsible. She is grateful every day she enters the kitchen to see him studying, his books spread out on the table. She lifts the cup of tea close to her face, its steam rising. Amar scribbles in his black notebook, the edges of his pages fluttering. He is hiding something from her. She has suspected it for weeks, maybe even months.
You would let him get away with anything, Hadia had said recently, when they were arguing about her not answering Layla's calls, You have no idea what he does and what he hides.
You only care about what your girls do, where they go, and with who.
No idea of what?
What does he hide? Leila had asked.
Nothing, Hadia said. Forget it.
Today marks 16 years from what would have been the due date of her fourth child. It is her secret. Not in the sense that she is the only one who knows, but that she is the only one who still carries it. Rafiq assumed all sense of loss had left when the reminders had passed, but Leila, even now, sometimes removes her necklaces and spare coins from the jewelry box to find the ultrasound photograph. So indistinguishable from any other that if her children were to come across it, they might think it was the first image of them.
Come inside, she wants to say to Omar. It is warmer in here.
The soft hum of the heater, her shawl draped over her shoulders, the cup of tea she brings to her lips. She watches him write. He is so serious. She had thought it was another whim, but it has been years, and he has not been parted from his notebooks. Back when he was still in high school, he once pulled his notebook out at dinner and wrote a line before returning it to his pocket. She had tried to glance over. Hadia nudged him and sang, "Omar wants to be a poet," stretching out the word, smiling. Rafiq had not torn his gaze from Omar. The look on Rafiq's face soured.
"My father was a painter," Leila had said to Omar.
"He painted some Sundays. It was not his job," Rafiq said.
Then after some silence, he added,
"He knew better than to confuse a hobby with a respectable profession."
Omar left his plate untouched, and a moment later, his bedroom door slammed shut. She has yet to glimpse a page. She wonders if he keeps his old journals in the black box that her daughters had dragged her to an antique store to buy years ago. Such an odd birthday gift that she was convinced he would not like it. But her daughters had insisted. Leila had bought him a new net for his basketball hoop and some other smaller gifts, had baked him a cake and ordered pizza. But to her complete surprise, when Omar ripped off the wrapping and saw the box, he had gasped, unlocked the latch so carefully, and ran his hands along the deep red velvet inside. He hugged Hadia and Huda first, as though he knew they were the ones to thank, before remembering to thank her and Rafiq. He always kept it locked. Her tea has cooled. She sips it, looking up at the framed photograph of her family, which she dislikes because the gap between Omar and Rafiq has always felt too revealing. But today, it makes her think of that other child, and what it would have been like for him to have been in their lives, their family. From him we are, and to him we return. A phrase recited in Arabic when hearing of someone's death. Surely there is evidence for the line present in all aspects of life, not just in the face of death. This house, this table, this teacup she sips from. Who is to say one day it might not all be taken? Our children are not our own, as our lives are not our own. All are a loan from God, his temporary gift. Omar looks through the glass door at her, and she raises her hand to wave at him. He gives her a small smile, then tucks his notebook back in his pocket. Maybe if she shares with him what she has shared with no one else, he will open up to her. A friendship will develop between them. After all, she knows her children, knows their habits and tastes, even as she is becoming increasingly aware that they can easily choose to not speak of their lives. It is they who do not know her, who make no attempt to. Omar kicks his shoes on the mat outside and closes the sliding door behind him. Without saying a word, he enters and lays his head on her lap, stretches his legs on the couch. The hum of the heater quiets. "You are hurt about something," she says it softly, touches his eyebrow from one end to the other.
When he was a boy, this is how she would calm him back to sleep after a nightmare. Both eyebrows at once, her thumbs reaching the edge of his face, then beginning at the center again. When he got older and his nightmares worsened, he would stumble into their bedroom and, in a daze, would fall asleep at the foot of their bed. She would cover him with a spare blanket and whisper prayers that she blew on him before falling back asleep herself. By morning, he would be gone, the blanket folded neatly and put back in their closet. He shakes his head, bites the side of his cheek. You can't lie to your mother. You can try to lie to everyone else, but a mother? A mother always knows. He smiles. It's nothing, Ma. I promise you. Oh, Ami, there is always something with you. Maybe that makes life interesting? He shrugs as he says it. Living is interesting enough. Don't make the mistake of confusing a sad state with an interesting life. He has grown too old now for her to guess exactly what is bothering him. But the sense of knowing he's bothered has never left her. She runs her hand through his hair. He closes his eyes. Ma? Yes? Do you think I'll be able to transfer? Of course. You've been working so hard. Do you think I'll be able to become a doctor? She stops moving her hand, rests it on his forehead. Is that what you want? She asks. He opens his eyes. You hesitated. No, I'm only surprised it is what you want. I was just watching you writing in the garden and remembered when Hadia said you wanted to be a poet. Has Baba been talking to you? He shakes his head. She has let him down. You'd make a fine doctor, Ami. He does not work nearly as hard as Hadia. He begins, then abandons, gives up easily what he does not care for. Are you enjoying the classes? He shrugs. She bites her lip, promises herself to be more careful with her words. She will have to ask Rafiq to not pressure Amar too much. Still, she is glad he has told her he is thinking about it. Even though Hadia was their first, even though Huda, their heartfelt believer, she has always felt instinctively that she and Amar had their own understanding, one she could never establish with her daughters. If her daughters banished him from their games, it was she who lifted Amar into her arms and distracted him with a walk outside, drew lines with chalk in the cement section of their garden, and sang as he jumped from square to square. Once, when her children were much younger, she had found him sniffling after her girls had shut him out of their room. He refused to tell her what was the matter until she had pried it out of him, and even then, all he had said was, "They don't love me." It was this that angered her, and she led Hadia by her arm to her bedroom and shut the door behind them, knelt until they were eye to eye. "Do you think it's funny to hurt your brother?" She tightened her grip. Hadia's eyes widened. "Right now it is funny to you both to tease him, to leave him out. It is a big joke you forget about. Maybe he also forgets, but you are his sister. It is your duty to take care of him. If you treat him horribly, Huda will treat him horribly." "He doesn't know the way we play. He's too little." "Then play something else." "That's not fair." "One day the joke will not be funny. If you always leave him out, if you always tease him and hurt his feelings, soon you will not know how to be any other way with him, and it will affect his personality, your relationship, for his whole life and the rest of yours. Do you understand that, Hadia? Whose fault will that be then?" Hadia had begun crying. Leila let go. "Whose fault?"
"Mine."
She had wanted to have another son to give Amar a brother, She thought that a brother would make him feel less alone. That first week following her miscarriage, she was certain he sensed her grieving. He would find her sitting at the kitchen table, staring out at her garden, unwilling or unable to do the task that was before her. The simple washing of dishes, the preparing of dinner, even eating her own breakfast that Rafiq had so kindly set out for her before going to work. And Amar would wordlessly climb into her lap, rest his head on her chest, and look up at her with his big brown eyes.
"Can you keep a secret?" she asks him now.
"Depends on the secret."
His teasing smile looks unfamiliar upside down. She tisks at him. How can she tell Amar in a way that will not cause him pain?
"I was going to have a child once after you."
"You wanted to?"
"I almost did."
He sits up. He faces her.
"I don't remember," he says, shaking his head.
"None of you knew. Hadia and Huda still do not know. Rafiq and I kept it a secret the first few months, hoping it would protect from Nazar."
Amar is silent while she explains. He plays with the edge of his shirt as if trying to tear it. She is surprised to find that she is speaking in medical terminology she had not even thought she had grasped when the doctor first told her. Her voice is without any emotion, as though she has stepped aside from her own feelings, so Amar can encounter the news unbiased.
"I named him Jafar," she says, and that is when the emotion floods back into her voice, when what she is sharing becomes hers again. "I wanted you to know."
He leans against her shoulder and does not look up when she tells him how Rafiq had left them with Seema Auntie for a few nights, how he assured her that the Ali family had the most children close to their children's age, and that if they had company, they would not miss Layla as much. But on the drive home from the hospital, when Layla looked to Rafiq, she felt no comfort, and in the empty house, she longed for her children to be brought home to her, even though Rafiq insisted it would be best if she rested a few days without any obligations to attend to. She tells Amar about the woman in the mosque who calls for her son by that name, and how hearing it sometimes shocks her. Or how at the grocery store, if the clerk asks her how many children she has, she catches herself replying, 4.
"Your Baba has not asked me about it once since," she says.
It is the closest she has come to complaining about her husband to her son, to anyone. And when Amar does look up, his eyes are lit with anger. After hearing of the eldest Ali boy's death, Hadia refuses to drink water for the 3 days leading up to his funeral. It is her only tangible act of mourning, and she keeps it in secret. She does not cry. It would have given it away that she had loved him in her own quiet way. On the day of the funeral, she stays in bed and waits for the call to tell her it is time. She is grateful she has been home on break. Just a week ago, Mama had hosted a jashan in her honor. She would be able to go on to her university's medical school. After the reciters closed their poetry books, they all gathered in the garden for lunch. And it was then that Hadia had seen Abbas Ali for the last time, leaning against the side of her house in his white shirt, laughing with Amar at a joke she couldn't hear. He had begun to wear his hair long again, the way he had when he was 9, and organizing Capture the Flag and games of tag in their backyards. Today he will be buried. And in 2 days, she will have to get back in her car and drive the long 5 hours, keeping her grip steady on the wheel, to return to school, where she will somehow begin another semester. Life will go on normally, and this seems like the most impossible fact of all. She is afraid to see his body, to have the news confirmed so irrefutably,
The entire community is in a state of disbelief. A death so young, so sudden. Someone so well-liked by both the elders and the children. Someone who occupied an unvoiced corner of every young woman's heart in the community. The fan moves slowly, and Hadia tries to focus on a single blade, watching it spin and spin. She thinks of flashing lights, ambulances arriving too late, shards of glass glimmering on concrete, his sister, whose knees collapsed upon hearing the news. She knows the crossroad where people have left bouquets by the stop sign, tied balloons to the pole, left letters on the metal gates nearby, their edges flapping. There had been 4 young men in the car, Abbas Ali and his friends from community college, and all were dead now except one, who had been buckled in the back seat. If she had been another kind of woman, Hadia is sure she would have had the courage to seek him out, ask him what Abbas spoke of that night. The one who survived is still in the hospital. They say he's not doing well. Hadia wonders what it would be like to enter a car with close friends and be the only one to leave it. She turns away from the fan, convinced it is making her nauseous. And there it is, that small piece of gum wrapper still taped to her ceiling, from when she had stood on her bed on tiptoe as a young girl and stuck it there. She had drawn a small strawberry on the gum wrapper. Almost a decade ago. She had forgotten about it. Saw it from time to time over the years, and it had always struck her as silly and embarrassing, as if she were no better than the girls who wrote Mrs. next to the last names of their crushes. Still, she had never had the heart to take it down. The events surrounding the silver wrapper are blurred. He had given it to her, she remembers that much, as well as the soft scrape of her fingertips against his palm. The last time she saw Abbas, she had spoken to him. Each time she returns to the conversation, the memory loses some of its certainty. He is already becoming a long time ago. Everyone was gathered in their backyard. People eating together, laughing together, lining up to pray together. Hadia sat in the scratchy grass, balancing her plate of food on her leg. And Huda was leaning on her because Huda was always so happy and extra affectionate the first few days Hadia came home. She could see the eldest Ali boy heaping food on his own plate. And Hadia felt surprised the community boys had managed a whole hour without once disappearing, as they always did, and as the girls were always envious they could, even if they rolled their eyes when the boys returned, smelling faintly of smoke. Amar had put extra effort into his clothes and hair, and he looked strikingly like photographs of Baba at that age. She remembered thinking, maybe this is what it is like for all of us to be almost but not quite yet adults. She was climbing the stairs for a break from everyone when she heard the eldest Ali boy call her name. She placed a hand on the banister. She turned on her heel, 2 steps above him, and smiled at her added height. They were eye to eye. "You're back," he might have said to her, to which she might have done the slightest of curtsies as if to respond, "Here I am." "You made the lassi?" he asked. "I helped." What else was there for them to talk about, when they were hardly allowed to? She too could bring up lists and lists of nothings just to be talking. Hadia debated if she should continue up the stairs. "Do you remember that day you were about to leave?" he asked. Of course she remembered. It was the day they had made lassi together. "That was 3 years ago," she said. And he raised his eyebrows in surprise. "Do you remember what I said that day?" She shook her head. She moved her hand to hold onto her arm. Then she let go, afraid her posture might appear weak, uninviting.
I told you that I knew you'd make us proud, he said. You've always been the best of us.
You never said that, she said, shaking her head and allowing a smile to escape her.
Didn't I? Well, I meant to.
He was smiling wide. She was too. They stood like that for a long moment, and she had the sense that they were both aware of some secret. The thought she had pushed aside since she was a young girl rose up one last time. That hope, or intuition, that he was, in his own way, in the only way he could, courting her by being kind to her brother. Then she blinked and the moment was lost. Not knowing how to offer a response that hummed the way his did, she asked how things had been at home since her last visit.
Same as always, he said,
and he turned to the framed family photographs that trailed the wall up the stairs, and she looked too, the one of her and Huda in their horrible collared and puffy dresses, the one of them smiling with their blue braces, one of Amar climbing the magnolia tree. Still keeping an eye on Amar for me? She asked, and this seemed to hum just a bit, the way she said, for me.
You know I don't have to answer that.
They turned when they heard someone descending the stairs.
It was Amira Ali.
Hadia tensed to be discovered speaking to Abbas in private, but it was Amira who looked like she had been stumbled upon, and Abbas who handled the moment gracefully.
There you are, he said to her, as if he had been searching for her the whole time. We're leaving soon.
Amira gestured behind her. The bathrooms downstairs were taken. He turned to head back outside, and Amira smiled her timid smile when she passed Hadia and followed her brother down the stairs. Just before Abbas turned the corner, he looked back and said,
Congratulations again.
Or maybe it was,
I was right back then.
And he held his hand up in a wave. And maybe she nodded. And maybe she stood still. There is a knock on the door, and she knows by the sound and length of pause before the second rap that it is Amar. When she opens the door to her brother, Hadia looks at him, for the first time not as her younger brother, but as the young man he's becoming, the hints in his face and demeanor that allow her to picture what he will look like in 10 years. 20 years. Her apprehension rises, unbridled, and accompanied by a fully formed fear. She is afraid it is possible that he too could die as suddenly and as young as the eldest Ali boy. It had not occurred to her before this week that one could lose a sibling, nor had she considered how easily the crash could have happened on one of the many nights Amar was with Abbas. Amar looks at her curiously, possibly mistaking her fear for anxiety over the event they are about to attend, and he softly says,
Ready?
They follow their parents to the car. Everyone appears to be elsewhere. Amar cannot decide if he wants the top button on his shirt buttoned, so he keeps his fingers there, doing and undoing it repeatedly. Abbas treated Amar like a brother. And Amar had reciprocated that tenderness tenfold. He is free to be angry and inconsolable, to invite everyone to sit with him and then to shut them out again. And when he stood in the driveway, as he did last night and shot hoops over and over again in the moonlight for hours, when he kicked the basketball against the garage door and it sounded like thunder inside, his reaction was both witnessed and excused. They drive to the funeral in silence. Hadia rests her head against the window. It surprises her, the little details she can suddenly remember about Abbas Ali, despite having spent a life only in each other's periphery. It is as though a root of her mind has been uncovered and outmarch the dizzying sights of him. A shirt he wore, the color of leaves, the blackberries he ate from the bowl in their kitchen, the soda he once spilled at a community party,
the wooden keychain of a tiger on his backpack from the days she sat behind him in Sunday school. How he asked her once why she liked her plum tree. How he slowed when playing soccer to pass the ball to her, his eyes speckled with orange and gold, telling her, "Inshallah, all will be well." Just before walking into the wake, Hadia turns to Amar and touches his shoulder, as if about to speak. He looks at her. But Hadia does not know what she wants to say. Would it be easier to tell Huda? He raises an eyebrow to encourage her. She wants to tell him she loved the eldest Ali boy. She wants him to know this loss is not his alone, that when she reached out to touch his shoulder, it was not just to offer solace, but to ask for comfort too. "What is it?" Amar stops to ask her. Hadia shakes her head and walks past him, past her parents, past the crowd of solemn faces. She catches a glimpse of the family members once inside. Uncle Ali stands to shake the hand of everyone who has come, and Amira is seated on the floor, her face hidden by her own hand. Hadia is grateful they do not make eye contact, suddenly ashamed of her audacity to think she even has a loss to grieve when a girl has just lost her brother, a father his firstborn son. Her mouth is dry, and she walks through the halls and heads straight to the bathroom. She shuts the door behind her and turns to her own reflection. She does not cry, but she does think of how Mama only knocked on Amar's door after the news came. How it did not even occur to her to check on her daughters. What she wanted was for someone to know, for her sadness to not go unnoticed anymore. She wanted, more than anything, to lay her head in her mother's lap, the way Amar often did, and tell her she had lost the first boy she had ever loved, the one she had maintained a distant devotion for since she first realized it was possible to feel for another. She wanted Mama to stroke her hair the way she touched Amar's after the news, over and over, as if making sure he was really there, so stunned and lucky that he was alive. All these years, she imagined her life would one day merge with the Basalis. Their entangling had felt inevitable to her. And for this reason, and because it would be improper, she had not broken the barrier of silence between them. Her reflection, her tired face. She touches her dry bottom lip and thinks of how odd it is to experience a secret loss. A loss without a name. The loss of a potential version of her life. Of what she never had, and now never will. The realization that in her own small and sustained way, she had loved someone for years that she had only looked at in glimpses, only spoken to in passing, only thought of in secret, only ever touched when they passed a cup of lassi or a stick of gum between them. Written at the top of the spelling test in red ink is 100%. Amar's teacher even wrote a little note. "Good job, Amar. Wonderful improvement." Amar is ecstatic. He waves the paper in front of Hadia's face like it's a flag, points at the number, as though the red were not enough to draw her attention to it. "You did it," Hadia tells him the first time he shows her. The second time, she only nods, but Mama acts like every time she sees it is the first. She tapes the test on the refrigerator door, even though they are not like other families with magnets and photographs on their refrigerator. Mama leans in to kiss Amar's cheek. She tells him that as soon as Baba comes home, she will show him the test, and that no one is more deserving of the shoes he will get. At night, Amar comes to Hadia's bedroom to thank her. His pajamas are dark blue with planets and white stars. Hadia tells herself to hug him, that he does deserve it. "I wouldn't have been able to do it without you," he says, and she can tell from the look in his eyes and the tone of his voice that he means it.
It's not a big deal, she says. She had meant that helping him was not a big deal, but her voice has a sharpened edge to it she did not intend, and he flinches a bit to hear it.
Downstairs in the closet, his white shoes have the word written in black ink. When she first studied his test taped on the refrigerator door, she saw that each letter was written with so much care, so unlike his usual scribbles, that at first glance, Hadia confused his handwriting with hers. It occurred to her that Amar could do anything if he tried. Maybe even better than Hadia could. He had only studied 2 nights. After he leaves, she opens her bottom desk drawer, where she has kept all of her important tests and papers, and all of them are A's, and none of them have been seen by anyone but her. Amar was the one they loved the most. He was the one whose picture Mama kept in her wallet behind her license. Him smiling with a toothless grin. Mama ran her fingers through his hair as if it nourished her. A painting he did of a boat on the ocean was tacked above Baba's office desk when she visited him at work. Once Hadia spent an entire afternoon counting the faces in the framed pictures, and Amar had beaten them all by 7. Hadia and Huda were a 2-for-1 deal. If there was a framed picture of them, they were likely together. Mama served food for Amar first, and then Baba, and she always asked Amar if he wanted seconds. She was not even aware of doing it. Hadia's daily chore was washing the dishes, and Huda's was sweeping. If Amar was asked to help, the two of them would shout and cheer to mark the day. Sometimes this made Hadia so angry that if she was left in charge of the cleaning while Mama and Baba were out, she would delegate everything to Amar. He was the only one Mama had a nickname for. His favorite ice cream flavor was always stocked in the fridge. If Hadia helped unload the groceries and saw a pistachio and almond carton, she reminded Baba that Amar was the only one of them who ate that flavor.
You don't love it too? Baba would ask her distractedly every time.
No, she'd say quietly, thinking there was no point in correcting him at all. Once, only once, had she confronted her mother about this, after her mother had taken his side during a fight that he was clearly to blame for.
You love him more, she had shouted. You love him more than all of us.
Don't be silly. Her mother was calm, as if she was bored by Hadia's tantrum.
You think about him more, what he needs and what he wants.
Hadia had turned to run back into her room.
We worry about him more,
her mother had called after her, so gently that Hadia had wanted to believe her.
We don't have to worry about you.
She had sniffled and locked her bedroom door, embarrassed by her outburst. She plotted to do something that would make her parents worry about her, as if their worry would prove the depth of their love. But she was afraid. They had endless patience for Amar's antics. She feared the only thing worse than wondering if they loved him more was testing their patience, proving it to be thin, and knowing for certain. They loved Hadia because she did well. Her grades were good, and her teachers said kind things about her. She was not sure if Baba would even notice her at all if she did not work hard to distinguish herself academically. The only compliment Mama ever gave her was that when Hadia cleaned the stove, it always sparkled.
Even I can't clean like that, Mama would say.
And there would be actual awe in her voice, and Hadia would never know if she should feel glad for the compliment or annoyed that it was the only thing that Mama valued enough to note. Amar was their son. Even the word son felt like something shiny and golden to her, like the actual sun that reigned over their days. Baba would sometimes say to Hadia,
"One day you will live with your husband. You'll care for his parents. You'll forget about us."
It was meant as a joke.
"You'll forget about us," or "We will no longer be responsible for you."
But it was never funny.
"Amar will take care of us, right, Ami?"
Mama would squeeze his cheeks. Amar would nod.
"Why can't I?" she would say.
"Because the role of the daughter is to go off, to make her own home, to take her husband's name. Daughters are never really ours," Baba would tell her.
"But I want to be yours," she'd want to say. "I want to be yours, or just my own."
"I won't take anyone's name," she'd vowed aloud,
but he would have stopped listening. Everyone important was a boy. The prophets and the imams had been men. The Maulana was always a man. Jonah got to be swallowed by the whale. Joseph was given the colorful coat and the powerful dreams. Noah knew the flood was coming, whereas Noah's wife was silly and drowned. Eve was the first to reach for the fruit. But Hadia liked to keep her examples close. It was Moses' sister who had the clever idea to put him in the basket, and the Pharaoh's wife who had the heart to pull him from the river. It was Bibi Maryam who was given the miracle of Jesus. Bibi Fatima was the only child the prophet had, and the prophet never lamented the lack of a son. And she liked to think that there was a reason that one of the first things the prophet ever did was forbid the people of Quraysh from burying their newborn daughters alive. But still, hundreds and hundreds of years had passed, and it was still the son they cherished, the son their pride depended on, the son who would carry their name into the next generation. She holds on to the banister to guide her. Everyone but Baba is asleep. She is supposed to be asleep too, but she is thirsty and has dared to tiptoe downstairs for a glass of water. Amar's test dominates the refrigerator door. In the blue light, the ink of the 100% appears purple. She's not sure what to name her feeling, but she knows she does not like it, the way it shrinks her heart. That there could be a limit to the happiness she could feel for Amar. Earlier that night, Baba came home and he and Amar had shaken hands like businessmen. But when Baba told him they would go that weekend to the mall, Amar became again a boy who could cheer hooray and hug his arms so tightly around Baba's legs that Baba started to laugh. Mama had reached out and touched Baba's arm and smiled at him when he looked at her. Baba had been generous. He said that Amar could customize his shoes, which they knew from the posters cost extra. Amar was grateful, but when he spoke to Hadia and Huda, he was arrogant. His shoes would be better than anything they owned. After Amar's test was posted on the refrigerator, she asked her mother if she could buy eyeliner and begin wearing lip gloss like the other girls at school. Maybe even wear it to Sunday school sometimes. There was a boy in her mosque that all the girls talked about, and they gathered in the bathroom and leaned toward their reflections in the mirror, their mouths little O's, to apply lip gloss with an expertly steady hand, and if he happened to walk by, they always laughed loudly. Hadia did not want to laugh when the eldest Ali boy walked by for no reason, and did not want to wear makeup just so he would look at her. But it would be nice to not be the only girl in her grade who was plain, who was dressed by her mother in oversized clothes. Mama told her, it was wrong to do things intentionally to attract attention.
"Don't be childish, Hadia," Mama said when Hadia reminded her that she had gotten A's on her recent tests. "It doesn't suit you. This was a special thing for Amar, you know that."
She knocks so quietly on Baba's open office door
It takes him a moment to look up from his paperwork.
Why aren't you asleep?
He asks, and he invites her inside by folding his fingers toward him. Baba removes the glasses from his face and sets them down.
I have to tell you something, she says.
Baba asks her to sit in the chair in front of his desk, and she sits. Baba has a paperweight on his desk that Hadia made in the fourth grade, fat and finished with glittery glaze. When the teacher first handed it back to her, she was so proud of how beautiful it was. Now, it looks like a blob she wishes he would throw away. But he has kept it, and Hadia thinks that maybe she has been mistaken. Maybe she should count again the faces in the framed photographs, ask Mama for what she wants in another way.
Amar told me you helped him a lot, Baba says to her. I'm proud of you.
It is exactly what she had wanted to hear. But now that she has heard it, she only wants to cry.
What did you have to tell me?
He asks.
Nothing. Never mind, she says,
and shakes her head. But Baba knows she is lying.
Tell me, Hadia. He leans forward.
He uses his about-to-be-angry voice. He looks impatiently at his watch and says,
It's late.
Baba is wearing his father's watch. It is old, but so nice, and it makes Baba's wrist look important. The watch has passed from father to son, and one day it will be Amar's. He does not even have to do anything to earn it. All he has to do is exist. And Hadia thinks of Mama leaning in to kiss Amar. How Mama always says to Amar, Mera beta, my son, but never says Meri beti to Hadia or Huda, as though daughters are unworthy of being called mine. Amar cheated. Look at the soles of his shoes, she blurts, and the words sound ugly as soon as they escape her mouth. Baba sits back in his seat. She had thought he would be instantly angry. This was the worst thing Amar could do, because it was a double lie, first to the teachers and then to his parents. But Baba just looks very tired.
Go to sleep, Hadia,
he says finally, and his voice is very thin. Earlier that evening, Amar had said to her, You know, Hadia, I always thought that you were the smartest one. I thought that because you were so smart, maybe Allah didn't give Mama Baba's other kids as much brains. But it's not so bad, not so hard to try. Now the thought occurs to her. What if she had not even wanted him to succeed all along? What if she liked being the smart Hadia, the responsible Hadia? The we are leaving the house in your care while we go out, okay, Hadia? She turns around in the doorway. Baba, you will still buy him the shoes, right? Baba runs his hand along his eyebrow and does not look up to answer her.
Go.
She begins to cry. She does not move. She does not know what she expected. But it was not this feeling, that she is the one who has done something very wrong.
Will you tell him I told?
She asks, her voice so small. He shakes his head.
He really did study, Baba. He didn't do anything else for 2 days.
Now,
he barks at her, pointing out the door.
I won't tell you again.
7. Leila waits until her children are seated on the padded puzzle piece mats in the children's nook before wandering the aisles. She likes how tall the shelves on either side of her are, likes the look of the dust suspended in the afternoon light. Her children seemed at peace and occupied, Huda lying on her back, flipping through a book, Hadia reading aloud to Amar, and Amar half leaning on her arm, trying to look at the pictures.
A pile of books are stacked by his knees from when they first arrived and ran around in a frenzy, pulling far more books than they would get through in a single sitting. What exactly is she looking for? She wonders, her fingers trailing spines. It is a Sunday. They are in a public library near their home, where Layla brings them on some weekends, especially when Rafiq is away. He left for a business trip earlier this morning and will return Thursday night. It is odd to her how used to his absence they have all become, and odder still that she does not mind it. When she speaks to her father on the phone now, she does not tell him when Rafiq is gone. Her father still worries for her in a way that he does not have to worry for Sarah, who has stayed in Hyderabad, who has never driven a day in her life, who lives in the apartment complex next door, and has someone to help her with the groceries and the cooking and cleaning. She realizes that her life has grown, and what she can now do with ease has expanded. Just years ago, Layla panicked at the thought of having to manage without Rafiq. But now, it seems that her house is relaxed when he's gone, and cautious when he's not. Hadia is 10 now, but still, she cannot leave them unattended for long. Layla walks to the lobby, where a librarian is typing fast on her keyboard without looking down once. She has short black hair, coral tear-shaped earrings. Layla never gets books for herself. Maybe she should. The books she once checked out with Hadia are now in her home again, for Amar. She pauses to admire the familiar illustrations, caterpillars and bright fish, a fireplace in a darkened room, a child playing in the shade of trees. What is surprising to Layla is that it is Hadia who picks them out for Amar. Hadia, who has grand ideas of how he should move through the world. So important to her that he reads the books that were her favorite at that age, that made her love reading. Amar should watch animal documentaries about tigers and lions and sharks. They should go, as a family, to the museums her school took her to. That these activities are good for Huda's and Amar's imaginations. These are Hadia's words. Her decision, too, that Amar not watch violent shows or movies. Amar not spend too many hours playing video games, because she did not. All by herself, Hadia chose not to do these things, and chose to watch dolphin documentaries, brought home books she read on the stairs or upside down on their living room couch, her hair falling down the side. Layla is amused, but also astonished, only allowing him the movie Hadia deems too scary for him if he comes to her crying. Where did they come from, her children? And how did they arrive already themselves and unlike anyone else?
Can I help you find something? The librarian asks. Her earrings sway when she tilts her head to one side.
Layla nods. Her children have not followed her here, and she has been away from them for no more than 5 minutes. She is unsure how to ask.
Books on children.
Fiction? A novel? A child protagonist?
No. Maybe a book if you sense that something might be a little wrong.
Health-wise? Or a mental illness?
No, she responds quickly. No, nothing like that, at all.
I'm not sure I understand, ma'am. She shifts from one foot to another, looks at the cuticles of her fingers as she tries to explain. For example, if he gets upset about little things, upset to the point where you wonder if this is normal. He is louder about his hurt than the girls were. They were less irritable. But perhaps it is just that he's a boy? What kind of stubborn behavior is normal and what is not? If he refuses to eat, for example. If he makes a decision and no one can shake him from it. And this may not be important. But say he began speaking at a later age. Say, for example, he is upset and he begins crying. He will do so until his voice is hoarse. He will kick his legs on the wall even after it bruises him. He will cry until he is exhausted, until he falls asleep. And it could be for the smallest reason. I lifted the shades up too abruptly without telling him. I poured milk when he wanted none. Or he says he did something when I know he didn't do it, brush his teeth, for example. But he insists so adamantly, I'm certain he believes himself. The woman is nodding slowly, her earrings moving too. And Leila cannot tell if she is concentrating or concerned. She is grateful her children are aisles and aisles away, and that Hadia cannot overhear her and become worried, or that this woman cannot see her son and know who she is betraying. Before returning to her children, she places the books at the bottom of their book bag, knowing Hadia or Huda would see the spines and ask questions. The librarian was kind, left her post at the desk, and led her through the aisles, gestured at entire shelves, but pulled certain books out, discussed them briefly. Leila nodded, thank you, she said quickly, so that the woman would leave her to flip through the books, and then return to her children, having decided that she did not even need them. But instead, Leila found herself pausing at sentences and sections, and every sentence seemed applicable to Amar, while also feeling impossible it could be him. She feared she was doing what Rafiq often accused her of doing. Worrying herself, finding something to be wrong only because she looked for it. But still, she would keep the books hidden in her bottom drawer, read them after her children were tucked in bed, and when her husband was away. Only if she, God forbid, came across a passage that was actually concerning, would she bother Rafiq with it. It might only make it worse if she brought it to his attention. She wishes Rafiq would be a little easier on Amar. Prays for a deepening in his patience. He is so easily angered, offended by little things when it comes to Amar. So what if he asked Huda to paint his nails too? It was no matter that he had no interest in the trucks that Rafiq bought him. Let him play in the garden, kicking up leaves. Let him watch the shows his sisters watched. It was true. He was a little sensitive. Leila's own father had not been an angry man. He painted, showed Leila his progress every week. But he had only daughters to raise. Maybe what a son evoked in a father was different than what a daughter evoked. It would be all right. She was only afraid that when time passed, it would not be these trips to the library he would remember, or his eagerness to learn how she made roti in the kitchen with him as her helper, but how upset he would become when Rafiq scolded him. When she sees her children again, her son is still leaning his head on her daughter's arm. Her daughter is flipping the page of a book. Her hand is angled up a little, so the cover is visible, and Leila can see it really is the same book they have checked out for years. Sometimes, when Leila reads them to her children, she opens up the cover and runs her fingers down the dates stamped onto the lined paper, wonders which of these dates of return have been theirs. If she had a camera with her, she would have pulled it out, taken a picture of the three of them unaware of her watching. How calm they are. A Sunday in their public library. How many times has she stood as she is standing now and looked at her children as she is watching them now? A way of seeing that magnifies her attention, deepens her love at the sight of them, and she notices them in a way she otherwise might not. The way the sunlight goldens the profile of their faces. The way Hadia scratches at her nose, adjusts her scarf that always looks a little big on her. Perhaps 100 times, just in a single week. Huda memorizing a poem for her class and wanting to recite it for her. Leila smiling at the way she looked up at the ceiling, as though the lines were projected there. What a little person.